This is the country of Myanmar, sometimes also referred to as Burma, and it really only appears as a functioning country in our imagination on maps. When you look further inside, Myanmar is without exaggeration the most geopolitically complex country on the planet today, where it's extremely difficult for outsiders to figure out what's actually going on. The country has been completely consumed by a brutal, multi-sided civil war that has been going on for more than 4 years now, that has shattered the country into a complicated mosaic of competing militias, warlords, resistance fighters, and a totalitarian central regime dominated by the military that came to power during a coup d'etat in early 2021 that overthrew the previous democratically elected government. You may have seen memes about this coup back when it happened then, centering around this woman who was filming herself performing an aerobic dance routine as the country's military was busy storming and overthrowing the government right behind her. That coup is what triggered the current civil war in the country, and over the past 4+ years of fighting across Myanmar since then, more than 82,000 people have been killed, while more than 3.2 million others have been internally displaced, making the war that's still raging in Myanmar among the most violent and destructive active conflicts taking place anywhere in the world today, but also one that has only attracted a fraction of the international attention as the other ongoing major wars in Ukraine and Gaza have garnered. But Myanmar, a country of some 54 million people in the heart of Southeast Asia, is actively in the process of dying, with potentially catastrophic consequences for the rest of Asia and the world. Myanmar's economy has crashed by at least 20% since the civil war began. The central government now controls only about 1/5 of the country's territory and virtually none of its own international borders with its neighbors. In the mostly lawless periphery border regions beyond the government's control, massive drug dealing and the largest scam factories in the world taking up entire skyscrapers involving tens of thousands of people have been established. Governments from around the world have warned their citizens not to travel anywhere in Myanmar due to the persistent threat of getting caught up in the war there. And the country is now at a serious risk of balkanizing or fragmenting and becoming another Yugoslavia or another Afghanistan, but on an even larger scale. And it's already become what is essentially the only failed state in Eastern Asia, located at the strategic crossroads between China, India, and the Bay of Bengal, with major, major consequences for everyone around them, especially China, who is becoming more and more forced to militarily intervene in the raging chaos that's going on immediately across from their southwestern border. To understand how Myanmar got to this point of potential state collapse today and to understand the severity of the potential consequences, it helps first to understand the series of events that led up to the coup and the civil war in 2021. Before 1989, the country was known as Burma, so that's the name I'll begin referring to it as for a bit from here. Burma, like many other places in the world, was steadily taken over by the British and ruled by them as a colonial possession for more than a century between 1824 and 1948. After Burma was eventually granted its independence by the British following the Second World War, it has consistently struggled with governing over its extremely diverse multi-ethnic society. Today, there are an astonishing 135 separate, distinct, recognized ethnic groups who are present in the country. The Bamar, whom the country's original name, Burma, derived from, have always made up the majority of the country's population, and today they represent around 68% of the total population, and dominate the center and most of the coast. The peripheries of the country, meanwhile, have always been populated by various ethnic minorities, with the largest being the Shan, Karen, Rakhine, Han Chinese, Mon, Indians, Kachin, and Chin. These minority groups in the country have always preferred to identify themselves as ethnic nationalities rather than ethnic minorities, because they've always, ever since the country's independence, been insecure and fearful about the political domination of the Bamar majority. To add an even further layer to the complexity, the overwhelming majority of Burma's society practices Buddhism, including most of the Bamar ethnic majority. But several of the minority ethnic groups predominantly practice either Christianity or Islam instead, like the Chin, Kachin, and Karen, who are predominantly Christians, and the Rohingya, who are predominantly Muslims. In the lead-up to Burma's post-war independence, the country's chief independence leader named Aung San promised that some of these ethnic minority groups would be granted their full autonomy within their own territories within Burma, with a further option to secede from Burma after 10 years had passed. However, Aung San was assassinated merely months before the country's independence was granted, and so his promises of autonomy to the ethnic minorities were never honored by the post-independence government, which almost immediately sparked major rebellions by many of the ethnic minorities who began forming their own armed militias to resist the central government's authority. And they became known as Ethnic Armed Organizations, or EAOs for short. With goals ranging from increased autonomy within Burma to a federalized system within Burma, or even to full-blown independence. Many of these EAOs have been continually engaged in a state of conflict with the central government for more than 77 years ever since then, making the conflict in Myanmar the longest continually running war that is still ongoing in the world today. In 1962, the Burmese military, known as the Tatmadaw, launched a coup d'etat that overthrew the parliamentary government and installed a totalitarian dictatorship under a military junta in its place that would last for the next several decades. The Tatmadaw, dominated by the country's ethnic Bamar Buddhist majority, continued refusing to implement a federal system within the country and dramatically increased the state's repression of its ethnic minority regions, continuing and exacerbating the fighting between the state and the EAOs around the periphery. At the same time, the Tatmadaw military dictatorship pursued a radical policy within Burma that sought to completely isolate the country from the rest of the outside world economically. Trade and contact with the outside world was largely eliminated. Most industries were nationalized, and Soviet-style central planning was combined with traditional Buddhist beliefs and deep local superstitions. The result was unbelievable economic mismanagement and crippling poverty. By 1987, after more than a quarter century of totalitarian Tatmadaw rule, Burma was the second most impoverished country on the entire planet, remaining only just barely ahead of nearby Cambodia, who had lost more than a quarter of its population only a few years earlier under the infamous regime of Pol Pot. The year after, in 1988, the level of popular discontent within the country had risen high enough that it exploded into a massive nationwide uprising involving hundreds of thousands of people. The Tatmadaw regime responded with a brutal armed crackdown, likely killing thousands of protesters in the process. Even though the Tatmadaw ended up squashing the uprising through force and continued remaining in power, it also realized that it needed to begin adopting reforms to prevent the same kind of uprising from ever happening again. The Tatmadaw regime unilaterally changed the country's name from Burma to Myanmar just the next year in 1989, in an attempt to distance itself from the country's colonial past and to be more inclusive of the country's many diverse ethnic groups apart from the Bamar. Though the name change has remained highly controversial ever since it was not decided democratically by a regime that seized power through force. The United States and several other countries around the world who do not recognize the country's military government as legitimate continue to insist on officially calling the country Burma instead, which is why on Google Maps and other apps, you'll continue seeing the dispute marked by both names being displayed at once. To further show how serious they supposedly were about reforming the country, the Tatmadaw also agreed to host the country's first open election in nearly three decades in 1990 that they, for some reason, confidently believed they would actually win. Instead, a party known as the National League for Democracy, or the NLD, won decisively. The NLD was led by a woman named Aung San Suu Kyi, the daughter of Aung San, Myanmar's independence-era hero who had advocated for federalism in the country and was assassinated decades earlier. Shocked by her and the NLD's victory in the 1990 election, the Tatmadaw regime simply refused to recognize the results and placed Aung San Suu Kyi under house arrest, which would last for much of the next 20 years for her until 2010. Over the years that followed, the Tatmadaw further consolidated their power in Myanmar and ramped up their attacks on the EAOs around the periphery, destroying most of their bases and strongholds by the mid-2000s and entering into ceasefire agreements with many of them. But the 1990 election results also showed the Tatmadaw just how unpopular they really were amongst the people they ruled over through force. And so to maintain their hold on power, they created what they called a roadmap to discipline democracy that culminated in 2008 with their drafting of a new constitution. This new constitution, for the first time in Myanmar's post-independence history, created five self-administered zones and one self-administered division for six of the country's ethnic minority groups, reducing the need for many of them to continue fighting. The Wa state, home to the Wa ethnic minority group, was granted so much autonomy within Myanmar through the 2008 constitution that it effectively has functioned as a de facto independent state ever since, with its own completely separate and independent political system and army with no declared allegiance to any of the rest of Myanmar. The Tatmadaw also released thousands of their political prisoners, including Aung San Suu Kyi, from her long house arrest, and agree to host another round of elections again in 2010, 20 years after their last elections that they refused to recognize back in 1990. However, unlike the 1990 election that surprised them, they made sure that no matter how bad the results of the 2010 election were for them, they would continue remaining largely in power without having to resort to force. They wrote into the 2008 constitution that at least 25% of all the parliamentary seats in the government would still be reserved for the military. The military alone would continue controlling the country's security policy without any civilian oversight, while the military would also continue appointing one of the country's two vice presidents, essentially ensuring that the military could veto any proposed constitutional amendments going forward. To try and even further shape the election outcome, the military also just banned anyone who was married to a foreign national from running for president, which was basically just an attempt to block Aung San Suu Kyi from running again, who was married to a British citizen. Her party decided to boycott the 2010 election in protest as a result, and so the military's preferred party won the election instead, and they remained largely in power. A few years later, Myanmar hosted another general election in 2015 that Suu Kyi's party, the NLD, finally participated in for the first time in a quarter century, and, like in the 1990 election, they once again won with the people decisively. But this time, unlike the 1990 election, the Tambadao actually decided to recognize the results and cautiously agree to enter into a power-sharing arrangement with the NLD, giving up a bit of their absolute grip over the country for the first time in more than 53 years since the 1962 coup. Since Aung San Suu Kyi herself was still legally barred from running for office, she never became Myanmar's president. But after the election, the NLD created a new position to give to her instead that they called the State Councilor, which made her the de facto leader of Myanmar anyway. It's hard to describe just how high the hopes were in the world for Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD's leadership in Myanmar after the 2015 election. There was a serious hope that after more than 50 years of continuous authoritarian military rule in the country, Suu Kyi was finally helping to transition the country towards democracy. But then, very quickly after her government began administrating things, the military decided to do something that captured the entire world's attention and severely undermined international trust in her government. The Rakhine State in the west of Myanmar, across the border from Bangladesh, has always been among the most unstable and violent regions in the country, stemming from its very high levels of ethnic and religious diversity. One of the largest groups of people present in the Rakhine State at the time were the Rohingya, one of the very few Indo-Aryan ethnic groups who predominantly practice the Islamic faith in the country. There used to be around 1 million Rohingya people who lived in the Rakhine State, but they've always faced enormous levels of persecution and disenfranchisement by the ethnic Bamar and Buddhist-majority Tambadao and the Myanmar government. The Myanmar government has continually maintained that the Indo-Aryan and predominantly Muslim Rohingya are not indigenous to the country, and that they were only brought over to settle in historic Burma by the British colonial government during the 19th century. The Rohingya themselves insist that their own history in the Rakhine State goes back thousands of years. But the Myanmar government refuses to even call them by their own name, officially calling them Bengalis instead to further discredit their right to live in the country. The government has asserted that the Rohingya are a product of British-era colonial settlement policies. And on that supposed basis, they stripped all of the 1 million-plus Rohingya in the country of their citizenship back in 1982. Which has left the Rohingya as the largest stateless population in the world ever since. Further restrictions were placed on the Rohingya's freedom of movement and education access, which led to multiple academics and scholars calling the conditions faced by the Rohingya in the Rakhine State as similar to the apartheid policies experienced in South Africa. Understandably, the Rohingya launched multiple armed insurrections against the military and the government throughout the 1990s and 2010s in the face of this repression. And in October of 2016, an attack by one Rohingya militant group on a police station in the Rakhine State killed 12 Tambadao police officers, which led to the military deciding to retaliate with genocidal fury. The Tambadao immediately launched an overwhelming crackdown in the Rakhine State against the entire Rohingya community, killing more than 6,700 Rohingya in just a single month, burning down and destroying enough Rohingya villages that they were captured by satellites, and forcefully driving out more than 700,000 Rohingya across the international border into Bangladesh as refugees. Representing most of Myanmar's entire Rohingya population, and one of the 21st century's most egregious cases of ethnic cleansing. It's likely that tens of thousands of Rohingya were ultimately massacred by the Tambadho during this crackdown in 2017. And their forcing of hundreds of thousands of survivors into Bangladesh triggered the largest refugee crisis in Asia seen since the Vietnam War, where around 1 million stateless Rohingya refugees with no citizenship anywhere continue living in political limbo to this day in the largest refugee camps in the world. A couple of years later, in 2019, the Gambia, on behalf of all 57 members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, introduced a legal case to the International Court of Justice accusing Myanmar of committing genocide against the Rohingya, which is still ongoing and has since been joined by many Western countries like the UK, Ireland, the Netherlands, Germany, France, Denmark, and Canada. As Myanmar State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi traveled to The Hague in December of 2019 to defend her country against the genocide charges, arguing to the dismay of many of her international supporters that while some war crimes have been committed by the military in the Rakhine State, no genocide of the Rohingya had actually taken place there, with her support from the West substantially eroded after making these arguments in International Criminal Court, Myanmar hosted another general election in November of 2020 that her NLD party once again won decisively for the second time in a row, leading the Tambadho military to begin growing concerned that the NLD's continued electoral success was posing a long-term threat to its own continued rule. So just like they did after the 1990 elections didn't go their way, the Tambadho just contested the 2020 elections as supposedly fraudulent. And then in February of 2021, they launched a full-blown coup against the civilian government that we began this video with, arresting dozens of the newly elected government officials before they could assume their positions and once again imprisoning Aung San Suu Kyi, who's remained in a mix of solitary confinement and house arrest for the past 4.5 years ever since. Almost immediately after the coup happened, protests against the violent seizure of power erupted in Myanmar's capital city, Naypyidaw, which the military characteristically responded to with overwhelming force, opening fire on the protesters with live ammunition and killing more than 600 people in the process. Thousands of politically motivated young people from the Bamar-majority heartland of the country then fled into Myanmar's surrounding mountainous peripheries, where they linked up with many of the long-standing and heavily armed EAOs to receive training and weapons, before returning back to the heartland again to engage in ambushes and partisan warfare against the restored military junta in the country, which catapulted Myanmar into a state of full-blown civil war. The junta responded with massive violence, launching airstrikes and military operations across the whole country against the resistance, and installed one of their own generals, Min Aung Hlaing, as the regime's de facto leader and acting president. Within a few months, the motley collection of forces opposed to the military regime, including ousted elected officials, pro-democracy protesters, and long-oppressed ethnic minorities, banded together and formed the National Unity Government, or NUG, with the officially stated goal of removing the military from power and establishing a fully federalized, democratic Myanmar in its place. Within time, the NUG established its armed wing called the People's Defense Force, or PDF, to fight against the junta and their allies in the country, which by 2024 would grow to encompass an estimated 85,000 soldiers. Over time, many of the 25 active and heavily armed EAOs around the periphery of the country, many of which have thousands of their own soldiers, began breaking their ceasefires with the government and aligning themselves with the pro-democracy forces in the country against the junta as the junta began losing ground, while a few other of the EAOs, for a variety of reasons, aligned themselves with the military instead. Beginning in late 2023, the Tambadho began experiencing an increasingly high number of military setbacks and loss of territory. As of mid-2025, the Tambadho only maintains its control over about one-fifth of Myanmar's territory, and has lost control over most of the country's external international borders, though it still dominates the Bamar heartland in the center of the country that is the most densely populated part of Myanmar with all of the most major cities. The PDF and the EAOs have consistently struggled with taking over major cities in the country during the civil war, and so while they currently control more territory than the regime does, most of it is sparsely populated rural countryside. Throughout the past 4+ years of war here, Western countries have largely ignored what's been going on, largely disillusioned with Myanmar's pro-democracy movement following Aung San Suu Kyi's defense of the military's genocide against the Rohingya, and distracted by other large-scale conflicts closer to home like Ukraine and Gaza. But in the absence of large-scale Western involvement in the conflict, China stepped onto the scene in Myanmar to fill the vacuum and has become by far the most influential outside power here, working together with both the military junta and various rebel factions at the same time to advance their own interests. Myanmar is one of the most important countries right now for China's geopolitical calculus, and Beijing's interests in the country are numerous. It is the only country that directly borders China that is experiencing a major war on its own territory. And so naturally, China would be concerned about ensuring stability along the entire length of their border that stretches and winds for nearly 2,100 kilometers. China is also highly concerned about suppressing any potential Western influence in Myanmar, represented the most by the NUG and the pro-democracy resistance in the country. There isn't a single country who directly borders China that is explicitly pro-Western right now, and China would like to keep it that way. A pro-Western government in power in Myanmar would become an outpost of Western influence on China's southwestern flank, with potentially disastrous consequences for China's strategic planning regarding an invasion of Taiwan. For this reason, China has primarily supported the Tan Mado military regime in power in the country, but has also supported a whole host of rebel EAOs at the same time who are not ideologically committed to democracy, undermining the NUG and the pro-democracy resistance while keeping Myanmar chronically unstable between the Tan Mado and the EAOs, neither of which have proven capable of decisively defeating the other over the years since they both received China's support in different ways at different times. From Beijing's perspective, the most ideal government in power in Myanmar would be pro-Chinese, like the Tan Mado has often been. But barring that, their next most preferable option would be an unstable Myanmar that cannot effectively push China's influence out. And the least preferable option would be a fully democratic, federalized Myanmar that would probably grow closer to the West and undermine China's strategically critical influence and investments in the country. What are these strategically critical Chinese investments in the country? Look no further than the oil and gas pipeline that they helped construct across Myanmar between 2009 and 2014 at a cost of billions of dollars. These two pipelines are known as the Sino-Myanmar pipelines, and they were built as a part of China's greater worldwide Belt and Road Initiative infrastructure program. Myanmar's territory is critical to China for these pipelines, because they provide China with a gateway into the Indian Ocean, and most importantly, they provide China with an alternative energy import route to the Strait of Malacca. Roughly 95% of China's energy imports currently travel into the country by sea, largely on the backs of tankers coming from the oil and gas-rich Persian Gulf as well as Russia. 80% of China's energy imports are currently forced by geography to funnel themselves through the narrow Strait of Malacca on their way to Chinese ports, a critical choke point that could become blockaded by the US Navy in the event of a war breaking out over Taiwan. Such an action would immediately eliminate the majority of China's energy imports required to sustain itself. So for decades, China has been busy building out alternative energy import routes to get around the Malacca Strait problem. And the Sino-Myanmar pipelines are some of these most important alternatives. They begin at the deepwater port of Kyaukpyu on the island of Rab Ree on Myanmar's coast, and then travel for nearly 2,500 kilometers across the whole country through mountainous and jungle-covered terrain before crossing over the border into China, where they continue extending towards the major city of Kunming, the capital and the largest city of China's southern Yunnan province. Financially, these twin oil and gas pipelines cut off about 3,000 kilometers and 5 to 6 days worth of travel time for energy resources to reach China's coasts, saving considerable money on transportation costs. But more importantly, they also enable China to import at least some amount of oil and gas without having to rely on shipping through the vulnerable Strait of Malacca. While the pipelines don't have enough capacity to support the whole of China's energy needs, they are probably enough to support at least southern China's regional needs, and they are still better than absolutely nothing. In 2019, the oil pipeline was able to provide roughly 7-8% of China's total crude oil imports, while the gas pipeline was able to provide about 2.6% of China's total gas imports. The gas pipeline, however, has been operating well below its total capacity for years now. If China is eventually able to get it operating at its full capacity, it could provide more than 20% of China's total gas imports instead. Together, the pipeline significantly reduced China's strategic exposure to its Strait of Malacca vulnerability, which gives China much more strategic flexibility when it comes to a potential assault on Taiwan. These pipelines running across Myanmar are therefore extremely valuable pieces of strategic infrastructure to China, and they represent China's biggest single interest and risk in the country. China wants to guarantee the security of these pipelines, but they run through several sections of Myanmar currently under both rebel and junta control that are experiencing heavy armed fighting. Despite this, however, throughout the entire past 4 years of war in Myanmar, the pipelines have remained almost completely untouched by anyone, because neither the junta nor any of the rebels they're fighting against want to incur China's wrath by ever touching them. The pipelines both begin at the port of Kyakpyu and then travel through Myanmar's Rakhine State first on their way to China. But the Rakhine State is currently almost completely controlled by one of the rebel EAOs fighting against the junta, the Arakan Army, or AA. The AA is currently besieging the port of Kyakpyu, still under tenuous junta control for now, where the pipelines both begin at. The AA has an estimated 50,000 fighters under their command currently, and they've been fighting against the junta to try and establish a similar status for themselves in the Rakhine State as exists in the Wa State. That is, a de facto independent state with complete autonomy inside Myanmar. In the entire history of the Myanmar conflict, going back to the country's independence, the central government has never before faced the prospect of a rebel faction coming so close to controlling the entirety of one of the country's states. And while you might think that China would be concerned about that, since it's where their pipelines begin at, they're not really, because they've actively pursued friendly relations with both the AA and the junta alike. Both the junta and the AA have promised China that they won't deploy heavy weaponry around the pipelines. While both the junta and the AA have also allowed China to deploy their own mercenaries to Kyakpyu as of February 2025 in order to defend the entrance to their pipelines. Which all on its own is a breathtaking development in this war. Only days before their deployment, the junta in Myanmar passed a new law that for the first time allowed foreign military personnel to operate within the country, but only under the guise of mercenaries. Chinese soldiers deployed to Myanmar only have to resign from their positions in the PLA before assuming their new mercenary roles, which effectively establishes a de facto Chinese military deployment to Myanmar without any of the diplomatic complications that might arise from a more public official deployment. The move has essentially created a Chinese version of the Russian Wagner Group, the state-owned mercenary company that Russia was able to deploy to theaters like Ukraine and Syria while maintaining plausible deniability. Now, for the first time, Chinese mercenaries are actively on the ground in Myanmar as well, with the explicit goal of defending China's pipelines in the country from the chaotic war that is raging all around them. The pipeline extends further through junta-controlled territory in the Bamar heartland in the center of the country, where it's come under rebel attacks on at least two separate occasions previously in February of 2022 and then again in May of 2023. But since then, the rebels have refrained from attacking the pipelines again, aware that China largely controls the flow of their ammunition and weapon supplies crossing over the porous border via proxy groups. As the pipelines continue progressing through Myanmar, they travel across the Shan State next before ultimately entering into China. These days, the Shan State is a complicated, largely lawless thunderdome of various warring EAOs, pro-democracy rebels, warlords, criminal syndicates, and the junta. A dangerous area for China's critical pipelines to travel through. Probably worried about this early on, the Tamado junta attempted to prove to China that they had their best interests at heart by placing landmines along the approaches to the pipelines to prevent any potential sabotage. But now, the pipelines run almost entirely through rebel-held territory in the Shan State all the way from the Bamar homeland right up to the Chinese border, meaning that both ends of the pipelines in Myanmar where they begin and where they enter China are currently under rebel control. This is also a fairly recent development, though. And just like in the Rakhine State, where China largely cooperates with the local EAOs, China cooperates with the local EAOs in the Shan State as well. In periphery areas where the junta's armed forces were stretched thin, such as in the Shan State, they relied on hiring private militias and border guard forces to fight against the resistance instead. Low on cash, though, the junta paid these proxies by essentially just allowing them to open up drug trades and establishing enormous criminal enterprises like sketchy casinos and online scam factories that mostly targeted people in China. The scale of these scam factories set up in the lawless frontiers of the Shan State are difficult to comprehend, especially if this is the first time you're ever hearing about them. Entire high-rise buildings were set up from nothing in the remote, lawless jungles full of trafficked people smuggled in from all around the world and forced to work against their will in various crypto scams, online dating frauds, Instagram and Facebook deepfakes, and more. By 2023, the UN estimated that some 120,000 people had been trafficked and imprisoned in these massive scam factories across Myanmar. Primarily targeting Chinese nationals, these Myanmar scam factories drain billions of dollars out of the Chinese economy. And in October of 2023, dozens of these trafficked people, some of whom were undercover Chinese agents, managed to stage an escape from one of these scam factories in the city of Kaohsiung, and were then shot at by the scam factory's guards, resulting in several of them getting killed. Growing frustrated with Automado's inability or refusal to shut these mega scam factories down that were now killing Chinese nationals, China likely gave the green light to a coalition of rebel factions known as the Three Brotherhood Alliance to launch an offensive against them in order to clear the scam factories out. This offensive became known as Operation 1027, named after the date that it was launched on October 27th of 2023. And to the surprise of almost everyone, including China, it quickly began steamrolling the junta. Thousands of the Tamado soldiers simply surrendered or deserted, and hundreds of the junta's positions collapsed. By the summer of 2024, the Brotherhood managed to capture the city of Lashio, with a population of around 100,000 people, the largest city to ever fall into the hands of an EAO in Myanmar's entire post-independence history. By that point, China feared the forces that they themselves had unleashed and worried that the Tamado regime was on the verge of collapse, potentially leading to unpredictable consequences, including China's worst-case scenario of a pro-Western government coming to power in the country. In an attempt to try and restore its control over the conflict and to ensure the security of its pipelines, China began pulling its strings on the Brotherhood, threatening to sever their supplies of water and electricity to them across the border, and most escalatory of all, kidnapping one of the Three Brotherhood's leaders and demanding they immediately enter into ceasefire negotiations. By April of 2025, the Brotherhood finally relented to China's pressure and returned Lashio back to the control of the Tamado junta, although the fighting across the Shan state and elsewhere in Myanmar continues. As Operation 1027 continued gaining momentum here, the Tamado began growing increasingly desperate to halt them by resorting to massive and indiscriminate airstrikes and artillery barrages against civilian targets, dramatically increasing the casualties of this horrible conflict. Knowing how much importance both the junta and the rebels place on appeasing China, some of Myanmar civilians have increasingly started sheltering around the pipelines, since they know that it's the last place either side will ever willingly attack. And thus, it's maybe the safest location for anyone to be at in the entire country now. In addition to the pipelines, China is also heavily interested in Myanmar's own natural resources as well. Myanmar generally produces about half of the entire world's heavy rare earth elements, a subset of rare earths including terbium and dysprosium that are critical for green technologies like wind turbines and EV batteries. Virtually all of Myanmar's heavy rare earths are also produced in a relatively narrow mining belt in the country's northern Kachin state, immediately across the border from China. But as the Chinese-encouraged Three Brotherhood Alliance routed the Tamado junta in the Shan state during the 1027 offensive, the Kachin Independence Army, or the KIA, an EAO operating within the Kachin state, managed to take advantage of the chaos and seize control over this heavy rare earth mining belt only a year later in October of 2024, dealing yet another major defeat to the junta. Since then, the production of half of the world's heavy rare earths have been controlled by a rebel army, one of the oldest in the country going back decades that has sought to achieve autonomy for the predominantly Christian Kachin people from the Buddhist Bamar majority. China dominates the processing of heavy rare earth elements, but they're also very reliant on importing the raw materials from this mining belt across the border in Myanmar that the KIA now controls, which has given the KIA more leverage over China than almost any other rebel group in Myanmar. In December of 2024, the KIA advance continued and they began laying siege to the major city of Bamo, which has remained under siege by them up until this video's production in mid-2025. Bamo is a major logistics hub for the junta and home to around 166,000 people, meaning that if it falls to the KIA, it will be by far the biggest city to fall to the rebels in Myanmar to date. Evidently fearful of another major city falling out of the junta's control to a rebel faction, China allegedly issued an ultimatum to the KIA in early 2025 to lift their siege of Bamo, or China would cease buying rare earths from the now KIA-controlled mines, which generated about $1.4 billion worth of trade in 2023 when the junta still controlled them. But the KIA, knowing full well how much China depends on these heavy rare earth mines for their own processing, has essentially tried calling their bluff and has so far refused to cooperate with their demands, continuing to besiege Bamo anyway in defiance with the belief that China will eventually cave in and resume trading with them again sooner or later. If Bomo falls, the KIA would be one step closer to achieving full control of the entire Kachin state. And if that happens, they believe that China would be left with no other choice but to sideline its support for the junta and negotiate with them directly instead, achieving both of their goals for autonomy and continuing to trade with China in the long run anyway. This development in the Kachin state highlights the limits of China's control of events in Myanmar. While Beijing was able to use the Three Brotherhood Alliance to clear out the huge scam factories on their border and then pressured them into not going too far by making them surrender their control over Lashio, they have not been able to compel the KIA into abandoning their siege of Bamo. And so, ever since late 2023, the rebels have been growing increasingly powerful across the country's peripheries. The Kachin, Shan, Kaya, Kayin, Chin, and Rakhine states on the peripheries, mostly populated by ethnic minorities, are currently mostly controlled by rebel EAO factions, while the Bamar majority interior is in a state where much of the countryside is controlled by the pro-democracy NUG rebels, with all of the major cities and urban areas still controlled by the Tambadho junta. Battered and demoralized, the junta has grown increasingly desperate and vicious to remain in power. At the onset of the coup in early 2021, the Tambadho had an estimated 300,000 soldiers within their ranks, which has since dwindled down to only around 130,000 still remaining today in mid-2025, as a result of high casualties and rampant desertion. In a major sign of the Tambadho's growing desperation, they began implementing forced conscription of men under their control in 2024 to address their growing manpower issues. And they've since forcibly conscripted around 30,000 men in the country, which has resulted in a huge exodus of young people fleeing from the country's major cities in order to dodge the possibility of becoming drafted, further worsening the country's crippling economic issues amidst the war. Then, to make matters in Myanmar somehow even worse than they already were, the country was also rocked by a devastating earthquake on the 28th of March, 2025, with an epicenter located only 20 kilometers away from the city of Mandalay, the second largest city in the country, right along the Sagaing fault line at the intersection of the India Plate and the Sunda Plate. With a magnitude of 7.7 on the Richter scale, it was astonishingly the most powerful earthquake to strike Myanmar in more than a century since 1912. And it just happened to strike at probably the worst possible moment while the country was consumed by its debilitating civil war. The true extent of damage caused by this earthquake to the country is impossible to know due to the civil war and the difficulty of acquiring accurate data from rebel-controlled areas in the countryside. That being said, there were many estimates. The World Bank estimated that the earthquake caused around $11 billion worth of property damage in Myanmar, equivalent to about 14% of Myanmar's current GDP. Tens of thousands of buildings across the country either collapsed or were severely damaged, while at least 5,300 people were killed in the disaster. The enormous scale of this disaster only added on further misery in Myanmar after more than 4 years of full-scale civil war that had already left tens of thousands of others dead. And despite initially agreeing to a ceasefire in the war to help assist with search and rescue and disaster recovery operations, the Tambadho almost immediately broke it and continued launching hundreds of airstrikes against rebel forces throughout the country only days later, almost immediately returning the country right back to full-scale fighting atop of the ruins left behind by the earthquake only days beforehand. By this point, Myanmar has become a failed state and a maw of chaos, instability, and war in the heart of Southeast Asia, with an unpredictable and deeply uncertain future. The rebels, while successful around the peripheries of Myanmar, are struggling to capture major cities and are struggling to advance deeper into the Bamar heartland, where soldiers belonging to the Tambadho junta, who are predominantly Bamars, will likely fight harder to repel advancing ethnic minority armies than they have previously out in the frontiers. Many of the EAOs have grown accustomed over these past few years to controlling their own territories, collecting their own taxes and revenues, and entering into their own negotiations with outside actors like China. And most of them seek a model for their own territories like the Wa state was granted back in 2008. They pretty much all seek to become de facto independent states within Myanmar with complete autonomy from the central government, with their own totally separate governments and armies. And they'll probably continue distrusting the central government in the country even if the Tambadho is removed from power and the pro-democracy NUG forces take over in their place, owing to the past several decades of prior negative experience. With the insistence of China, the Tambadho plans to host a new election in the country later this year or in early 2026 to try and legitimize and stabilize their rule in Myanmar. But how exactly they plan to do that with a civil war still continuing and with most of the country under rebel control will be anyone's best guess. There are several different paths forward that Myanmar could potentially take. Continued unstable civil war and chaos like Syria or Libya have faced for much longer with an undemocratic military regime that refuses to ever concede power. A victorious NUG democratic movement that finally transforms the country into a federalized system with almost completely autonomous statelets around the peripheries. Or further fragmentation and balkanization that leads to a total state collapse along ethnic and religious lines, like what happened in Yugoslavia during the 1990s, leaving behind a collection of small ethnic statelets around the peripheries and a Bamar-majority rump state left behind in the center. And all of this is happening as China continues to watch on from the outside with ever-increasing alarm and anxiety over their pipelines and their access to rare earth mines in the country, increasing Chinese military involvement to secure their investments and interests. Nearly a million stateless ethnic Rohingya who continue living in exile in refugee camps across the border in Bangladesh, unable to return, and all as other major ongoing wars in Ukraine and Gaza continue pulling the Western world's attention away from this other horrendous major conflict going on. News media and the Western world in general has seen a pretty significant downfall over the past few years that almost all of us have felt in one way or another. The older business model of newspapers stopped working as readers began switching to the internet, and in the modern digital space, media outlets are incentivized to chase clicks in order to increase revenue. But chasing after clicks means shifting towards more biased coverage of events that's more likely to trigger people's anger in order to capture their engagement. I know that over the past few years, it's gotten harder and harder to cut through all of this and develop a solid understanding of reality. But that's exactly what this video sponsor, Ground News, is trying to fix. Take this recent story about the Israeli military initiating airdrops of aid to the Gaza Strip. The overall coverage of this event is fairly balanced with a slight leaning towards the left. But Ground News identifies how left-leaning sources were more likely to underscore Gaza's humanitarian catastrophe, with terms like man-made starvation crisis and headlines framing Israel as seizing essential supplies. While right-leaning sources were more likely to emphasize Israel's swift, immediate resumption of aid accompanied by language like Hamas-controlled Gaza to question the aid's legitimacy. In addition, you can see what the source's ownership structure is, its historic factuality, and its typical political slant. But I think that the most fascinating feature of Ground News is Blind Spot, where you can see the major stories that people on the other side of the political aisle are seeing, but you're not. For example, right now, the right is talking about a secret meeting that France held with Hamas several years ago back in 2020. While the left is talking about how the Canadian Prime Minister called Israel's denial of humanitarian aid to Gaza a violation of international law. I genuinely believe that Ground News is a seriously useful tool in today's media environment. I use it all the time myself for research whenever my videos touch on politically charged subjects, which are basically all of them. It's an extremely useful tool for gaining and understanding a nuanced view of the news, and you can get access right now for a whole 40% off when you scan the QR code here on your screen or follow the link that's down below in the description at ground.news/reallifelore. You'll also be greatly helping to support my channel at the same time, so thank you if you sign up, and as always, thank you so much for watching.